But the big question now is, what about the McNamara timeline? That doesn't seem to work. Does it take 15 minutes to go to the beyond the height of land, or where she made the phone call? Does it take 15 minutes to drive from the accident site to that point? Did you drive it?
Yes. Yeah. So the oxygen series, well, their timeline actually just doesn't work.
I agree with you.
That was sort of a blaring mistake, but but I think their time for her was 7:37.
Okay, and 7:52 was the call?
Yes.
And that's inviolate. That's a fact, right, in the true sense of the term. So his crap doesn't work because he got there at 7:46.
Right.
So right there, that's the major crux of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Tearing that apart, it should totally reopen the case. In my mind,
because there's just no way.
So I want that discussed. I don't want the program to be able to say, well, that's that.
Welcome back. I'm Erin, and Ethan is here. And this episode is part two of the timeline and the time period between 7:27 and 7:52, the night that Moore disappeared. But first, I want to mention the Murrays announced that they're applying for a historical marker that would formally recognize and protect the location near where Moore disappeared. So if you haven't signed up for the Blue Ribbon campaign yet, please go to the family's website at moremurraymissing.org. and sign up to support that effort. And as to the real drama that everyone wants to talk about, the timeline. So I understand some people don't think that the timeline matters, and that's fine. But to me, it's not a question of if it matters or doesn't matter. It's under what conditions it matters. And until we know what those conditions are, I personally think it's worth exploring, so that's what this episode is about.
Mm-hmm.
It's this official timeline that Karen takes issue with.
I think it's significant that what I saw was before the police reported to have arrived. And so that says something's wrong. A day or two later, I got a call back from the police department, and they asked me, are you sure it was 001? And I thought it was odd that they would call back, and that's... They didn't say, like, are you sure you didn't see anybody? They were like, are you sure it was 001? I said, yeah.
So if Sergeant Smith was 9 minutes behind her, who was driving the police SUV?
So according to the Grafton County Sheriff's Department log, he arrived at 7:46.
Yeah, he actually got there a lot earlier. And that's in the interview that we did. You know how close it is to the Westman's house there? He just walked the 40 feet and talked to the Westmans and then called out.
So, I think last time we left off at 4:37, which is the last time that was on the phone records when Maura called her voicemail. So that's where we're picking up. And really, the next thing is 7:27 p.m. when Faith Westman calls 911. Although I will say before that, it's almost certain that she did get gas. We just don't know when or where.
Yes. And that's because the tank was mostly full.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think what makes sense is to go through the times that we know for sure, because they're written down in either dispatch logs or we know them from some other official recorded document, and then kind of like show what the problems are, or quote-unquote problems with the timeline, and then relax some of the assumptions about what events happened at what time and see, like, is it possible, for example, for Smith to have just showed up 10 minutes earlier?
Mm-hmm.
Possible might not be the right word. Of course it's possible, but like what sort of things have to be true in order for that to also be the case?
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So I guess like implicit in the timeline that everyone sort of agrees upon more or less is that things sort of happened in a certain order. So Westman calls 911. Butch shows up at the scene and talks to Maura. He leaves. Somehow Maura disappears. Butch calls 911. Smith shows up. Karen, witness A, shows up and sees his SUV parked nose to nose. So like those seven events, for lack of a better term, I think people are more or less in agreement upon the order of those.
Yeah, well, that's what the Oxygen show presented. That's how people probably typically imagine it.
Yeah, so these times are documented, recorded, and not in dispute in terms of like when they're recorded and documented.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we're all using the same source data here.
Yeah.
In terms of the logs as our source of like where these timestamps come from. And, you know, it's basically the logs and it's Witness A's account and her cell phone record.
Yeah, with the addition of Atwood's 911 call, which we never really knew before.
Yeah.
So at 7:27, Faith Westman called 911 and it was a 78-second call. And the transcript is on the website on my blog at 107degrees.com. But there's nothing really in there that we haven't already talked about. She said she thought that she saw a man smoking a cigarette and the car was in a ditch and she couldn't tell if there was any injury.
Yep.
So then at 7:29, Cecil Smith was dispatched to Moore's accident.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, jumps in whichever car, cruiser you think he's in.
Yeah.
And starts making his way to the scene.
Yeah. That was 2 minutes after Faith's call, right?
Yeah. Yep. So at 7:42 p.m., Butch Atwood called 911. And we know that because it was confirmed in writing by Chuck West. And it makes sense and it tracks because at the same time, or just about the same time, within 30 seconds, fire and EMS is dispatched as well. So there's been some questions about why the police waited 15 minutes between 7:27 and 7:42 to call out fire and EMS. But it kind of makes sense when you think about the fact that Butch is adding more information. He's saying that there's heavy damage. I don't know if I agree with that, but that's what he said. And he said that there's a woman who's shook up. So that information maybe triggered something that compelled them to dispatch fire and EMS.
Yeah. Yeah. I think especially the heavy damage, they're going to call it fire if they think there's a risk of a car fire. So from Faith's call, they wouldn't know any of that. But from a witness who's right there who says heavy damage, it's pretty hard to ignore that, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. You've got to play it safe at that point. And then also having seen a person, he didn't say she was injured, but he did say shook up. And what does that even mean? Again, you play it safe, call it EMS. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yep. So logically, at some point between 7:27 and 7:42, Atwood showed up, he talked to Maura, and he left.
Yeah.
There is only one report I could find where Westman says that the bus showed up like while she was on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't say it to the 911 dispatcher, so.
Right, yeah. Although, I do want to say, he said he made the... What was it? He was in the bus, writing, like looking at things at some point, so he would have seen something at that time. I can't remember those details.
He went into his house. He said that he told his wife about the car accident, and then he attempted to call 911, and he couldn't get through because there was a tie-up on the line. So there was definitely a certain amount of time where he wasn't watching the scene, because he's parking his bus, he's walking inside, he's
talking to his wife, he's making a phone call. Yeah.
Might have taken a pee and left that out.
Yeah.
Whatever you do when you get home.
Right.
But he says that he did see several cars go by. And when he called 911, it was from his porch. And he said that he couldn't see the car because it was so dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, that was at 7:42 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the next thing, and this is in the police report that Smith wrote, I think it was like 6 days later, he reports arriving at 7:45 p.m. Obviously, these are estimates because I think what they do is they have like little notebooks or probably laptops now where they arrive somewhere, they jot down like approximately what the time was so they can put it in their report later. And at 7:46 p.m., it's officially logged in the dispatch record.
Yeah.
So the big controversy is because of Witness A and her call from the Beaver Pond at 7:52. And we know that that's an exact time because we have a copy of her phone record for that day.
Yep.
So she definitely made a call at 7:52. And the earliest you can get reception is the Beaver Pond where she says she made the call. So that puts her at the scene at approximately, she's going the speed limit around 7:33, 7:34. She's speeding 7:38, 7:39.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not much later than that, though. So if we assume that Witness A and her timing is accurate, that means that, one, the dispatch logs are completely off, and Cecil Smith arrived much earlier than both the police report and the dispatch log says that he did, like 10 minutes earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were two different cars that night at the accident. Those are the only real possibilities.
Yeah.
And obviously the entertainment of the possibility that there were two cars is what people seem to react very strongly to, because it implies that there was some kind of massive police conspiracy. It doesn't actually imply anything.
Well, but there's two cars, that begs the question as to why that doesn't show up in any police report or mention whatsoever.
Right. Right.
It doesn't necessarily imply that there's a conspiracy, but it does sort of lead one to question that absence of mention.
I guess the first, maybe this is a good segue, maybe not, but what's the problem with the 7:35 timeline?
Right.
With Cecil showing up at 7:35, which, by the way, I get why people want to just, like, believe that. But for what it's worth, nobody has ever said that without entirely throwing art under the bus here. The police have not confirmed that.
No. No, the police have not. They haven't said anything about the timeline whatsoever, really. Mm-hmm.
But when I specifically asked them about whether Smith just showed up early and didn't call it in, they would not confirm Art's statement.
Right. So that is not something Art has inside information on.
It's just a guess. It's just a hypothetical.
That's a guess that he's making. And I would argue he's making it to make it work that it was Cecil there. There's no other reason to suppose that than to just to try to fit the officer who we know was there as the one that Witness A saw, to move that timestamp from 7:46 to 7:35-ish.
Right, approximately 11 minutes.
And that's a natural thing to want to do, obviously.
And it's possible. There's nothing saying it's impossible. It's just,
well,
we have to look at what assumptions it violates in order for that to be the case.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's the only piece of information that is typically or routinely moved by those who are looking into this from the place where it appears in the logs or in other official sources. That's the only one. Everything else, we can all basically agree the timestamps are approximately accurate, but that one is believed to be in the wrong place for whatever reason.
And just to give a quick, not exhaustive, but truncated rundown of the reasons to think that Cecil Smith probably showed up at 7:45 or 7:46 as opposed to 7:35. There's everything that Atwood has said. He says that Haverhill police showed up 7 to 9 minutes after he called 911, which would put them there at approximately 7:49.
Certainly after 7:42.
Yeah. There's an interview by one of the New Hampshire League of Investigators who talked to Tim and Faith Westman. And according to them, when Westman was asked about the timeline between the point when the police arrived after they had made their phone call, they said that it was about 15 minutes for the police to arrive after the bus left. There's the fact that it was reported that Cecil was at the Haverhill Police Department when he was dispatched. And he says the route that he took was north on Route 10, to Swiftwater, to Sawyer Hill Road, to 112, which is approximately 18 minutes by Google Maps, or, you know, if he's speeding, 14, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
There's the police report where he says he showed up at 7:45. There's the dispatch log where he says he shows up at 7:46.
I think those are the main items.
Yeah, those are the main data points. There's no data point whatsoever to suggest he got there any earlier.
Yes.
But it's not impossible. That's the point.
The only reason to put him there earlier is literally witness A. It's just witness A having said...
You can't believe the two simultaneously.
Right. Yes. So, and before the oxygen show, there was no effort to do that at all. Well, I mean, people talked about who was there and when and so forth. But the whole idea of moving Cecil Smith's arrival time to 7:35, I don't recall being particularly... The discussion was about whether Witness A could be believed and whether Witness A's sighting meant that Cecil was there or something else. So then when the oxygen show comes along... They look at this question. They take Witness A very seriously, right? Like Art said, you know.
And everyone does, to be fair. I don't think there's anyone saying that they don't.
Yeah, and the police seem to certainly take it very seriously. So if that's the case, then the only way for Cecil to be the officer that she saw is to move him 10 minutes. So then you see that sort of reasoning happening.
But interestingly, it does not happen on the oxygen show.
That's right. That's right. It was after. Yeah.
Their timeline has Karen showing up at, I think, 7:37 and Smith still showing up at 7:46. So
yeah,
the oxygen show actually never resolves that conflict. They just kind of leave it out there and say, oh, I guess it was Cecil because he says that he's in the SUV. And that's fine. That's totally fine.
Right. They focus on the question of what car he was driving.
Correct.
And they treat it as he said he was driving the SUV and therefore it's consistent with Karen's account. They don't look at the question of when she could have arrived on scene.
They do, but they just dismiss it. They don't go back to it. They don't. And whatever. I mean, whatever. But it was only after that Art threw out the hypothetical that, well, he could have arrived 10 minutes earlier and just didn't call in. I mean, he goes so far as to say that he goes to the Westmans first.
Yeah. Well, because he's trying to account for a rather long amount of time.
10 minutes. And the thing is, how would he even know where to go without radioing dispatch? Like, he's thinking that this girl is going to be at the car. She's not.
Yeah.
He needs more information.
Yeah.
Which even the prosecutor's podcast, they did a series about Mora's case. And these are prosecutors. And they actually said that, yeah, he broke protocol if he didn't call in. Like, he did not do that part of his job. Which is not, like, a huge deal. But,
you know, I don't know. I'm sure protocols get broken all the time. But it's also... Why? Like, why would you break that protocol? You know, like, I would think, and I'm not a police officer, but I would think it's almost automatic that when you arrive on scene, that it's almost involuntary that you get on the radio and you say you're there. Now, maybe it's not. But to me, I would think like that would normally be such a routine thing that they do on every call that if they don't do it, if they're off by more than a couple of minutes, I would think that was weird. It's not a difficult data point to enter. That's the other thing. It's not like this long narrative statement. It's a brief, you know, code arrived at scene. So
yeah,
nothing in Cecil Smith's interview on the Oxygen Show implied that he got there at the time Art says he did. You know, he didn't put timestamps down. So we're not even saying that it doesn't line up with what he said. Like, no, what he said lines up with arriving at the later time, as far as we could tell.
Yes. And he was asked during the interview, when you arrived at the scene, what did you do? Did you call in right away? And he says, I may have gotten out and looked around, seen if she was there, and then radioed back.
Yeah.
So he actually says that I got there, I looked around, I radioed back probably, if I didn't radio back immediately.
Yeah.
He did not say, as has been represented,
that he
went over to the Westmans first, which that wouldn't just be not calling in. That would be potentially entering a home without telling your dispatcher where you are. I mean, I'm not a cop, but I think that's a bad idea.
Yeah, seems unlikely. I can see why you would get out and look around, maybe, before coming in. Yeah, maybe I'm going to clear, you know, make sure the area is clear. Make sure there's no one, like, hiding or whatever in the bushes, you know, look around.
Or injured or whatever.
Yeah, and then I'm going to, yeah, especially if someone's injured, you know, time's of the essence. You know, maybe you delay making a call.
A minute or so?
A minute or so, yeah.
is if you arrived approximately around 7:45, as indicated in the police report, and then called in approximately 7:46, as indicated in the dispatch log.
Just four examples. Yeah, sure.
Well, the other thing is, the thing about Atwood's 911 call coming in at 7:42,
mm-hmm.
why would he call if the police were already there?
Right, because he wouldn't call 911 if he saw police lights on scene. There'd be no reason to.
Exactly. And yeah. according to Cecil, he had his blue lights on. It would be standard protocol to have your blue lights on. It would have been dangerous not to.
Yeah, it'd be super shady to not have your lights on in that situation.
Right, especially until fire showed up and could sort of like block off the road.
Yeah.
Which means it doesn't really matter if it was 7:33 or 7:38 when Karen showed up. What matters is, if we believe that her account is accurate, she saw a car at the scene before Butch Atwood called 911 at 7:42.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I don't want to be too harsh to Art, but he was not being fully truthful, I believe, when he said that Cecil showed up 10 minutes earlier and it's not there. No one ever mentioned it, but it happened. It had to have happened. That is nowhere in Cecil's interview. It goes against protocol. It goes against two different data points. There's just no evidence that he was there 10 minutes earlier and just never called in.
Yeah.
None.
Well, the only evidence is that witness A saw a car and he is mm-hmm. the only officer known to have been on the site. So that's, for Art, I would say that's probably all he needs.
Right.
You know, but I would also say, well, that's not proper deductive reasoning. Like, you're saying that, you know, well, I need there to only have been one officer. I need there not to be like a missing data point. So I'm going to say that, like, well, he must have been there 10 minutes before the dispatch logs indicate he was there, because that's the only way to square it with witness A's.
Right.
Statement. It's like, well, why are we assuming that it has to square?
Yeah. I mean, obviously he's a cop.
Yeah.
Or he has law enforcement.
Well, whatever. Yeah.
As much as he says that he is going to be open-minded, he also has literally said that part of what they wanted to do and part of their promise to law enforcement was they're going to squash mm-hmm. all of this conspiracy, all these conspiracy rumors. So I can understand why he's pissed off, because
yeah.
they didn't quite
It didn't work
that.
Out the way, yeah.
It's fine to have your biases.
Yeah. We know you're coming from a certain perspective. I can respect that. Mm-hmm. But you got to understand that we don't have that perspective, and we're not going right. to feel tied to your interpretation of things.
Right. If nothing else, it's a big question mark. And one that is very strange to dismiss, given that it is literally when she disappeared. Like, all the answers we're looking for are in that time frame.
Yes. The amount of time, like, you cannot bridge it. You can't bridge it and make it make sense.
Yeah. It's like, we know that this is a puzzle. And we have, I'm just throwing these out there, like, 35 pieces out of a 100-piece puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And people want to take those 35 pieces and make it fit as if it's the entire puzzle. And, like, just think about, like, what happens if you were to do that with a regular puzzle. Like, yeah. it doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense.
Yes.
You don't throw out the 65 other pieces.
Right.
Because you don't quite see how they fit yet. You wait.
Yeah, it's very, very frustrating. I mean, your puzzle analogy is really good. I really like that, because I kind of run into that a lot, where I'm looking at a problem and I know I don't have all the pieces, and the people around me are putting things together. And I'm like, well, mm-hmm. you know, you're missing something, though. So you really shouldn't expect it to fit right now.
Yeah.
And if you try to make it fit, you're going to possibly arrive at some incorrect conclusions. What you should be doing is trying to use what you have to lead you to what's the next piece. You know, look at what you have and then say, okay, well, it looks like there's a missing piece that would fit right here. Maybe I can find that piece somewhere. And obviously it's hard, because, like you said, we don't have all the pieces. So we have a certain number of pieces, and we can fit some of them together and we can't fit some of them. And then there's some that we don't even know if they exist or not, because we don't actually even know if yeah. it is a 100-piece puzzle or if it's a 1,000-piece puzzle.
Exactly.
You know, there's so much that we don't know. But yeah, the race to put it together rather than to find the missing pieces, I would say, is, to me, is a problem.
Yeah, I agree. Like you said, try to find the missing pieces instead of just reconfiguring the pieces that we have into the most ridiculous theories.
Shoving them in there. Yeah. Sticking with the puzzle analogy, I don't know if you've put together a lot of puzzles, but I love puzzles and I'm very good at puzzles. And the most annoying thing is when you're doing a puzzle with someone and they put in pieces that don't quite fit because it makes it so hard.
Right.
Because you're looking at the puzzle and like, oh, that piece is already in, that piece is already in. And you actually need those pieces somewhere else, or you have a piece that should go there, but you can't tell because there's a piece in the way.
And you kind of know, too, because it kind of doesn't look quite right.
Right.
But you're like, somebody else said it fits there, so I guess it does.
Yeah. And I have to take the view that's just like, no, I cannot assume
me too.
That these pieces are all correct, because I know that people will just shove it in there even if it doesn't quite fit, because they just want to get it done.
Yeah, well, then you get called confrontational. Or in your case, yeah. Assertive.
Oh, yes, I get complimented. I've been called anal retentive before. I have. And I don't dispute it. But if you're putting together a puzzle, it actually friggin' helps to be that way. I just have to point out.
Yeah. Well, I remember in one episode, I think you mentioned how a lot of times the person who did it is so obvious. And like, there doesn't have to be like a lot of detective work.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
But in cases where it's difficult and it's not obvious, you have to like really look at the details.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, don't really want to admit this, but I was watching a true crime show. I don't watch many of them, not gonna lie. I just lost like the 6 listeners that I have. But there is like this one show that I do like, and it's on ID and it's called Unusual Suspects. So they look at cold cases, and I mean, it's pretty formulaic. They're like, well,
sure.
This is a crime that happened. Here are the obvious suspects. And you're like, oh my God, it's so obviously that person. And then it's not. It's like somebody completely random.
That's awesome.
But it is kind of cool. And well, one of the reasons I even watched it was because it's about cold cases.
Right.
And every single one, the thing that cracks it is a completely benign detail that was totally ignored before. So like the one that comes to mind is there was this case at Philadelphia University, I'm pretty sure it was Temple, and this woman was working late at a computer lab on campus, and it was like 2 a.m. that she was discovered somebody killed her.
Mm-hmm.
And so they obviously interviewed everyone that she knew, everyone that was near scene at the campus. One of those people was a security guard that was working that night. Mm-hmm. And it went cold for a number of years. And then a new investigator took it over. And he was looking through the files. And he saw that the security guard, they asked him, you said that you passed through around 1 a.m. How do you know it was like 1 a.m.? And he said, well, because I heard the printers running or something like that about the printers running. And the investigator saw that actually the printers closed down at 10 p.m. every night. And from that one piece of information, that one detail, he was able to like look more into this guy. It was the guy. It was the security guard.
Wow.
He wasn't even on the radar.
Wow.
But that one little detail. And imagine if he was just like, who cares? He just messed up.
Yeah. Oh, he was mistaken, or maybe it was open that night for some reason. I don't know. Let me just shove that piece in there where I know it doesn't go. No one's going to notice or care.
Well, no one did until he finally saw it.
Yeah.
There were even more profound examples than that, but they're more complicated. That one's very easy to explain.
Yeah.
But the point is that details really do matter, especially in cases like this where it's not obvious.
Yeah. The colder the case, probably the more they matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's obviously a huge divisive theory or question in the case. It's because if you entertain the idea that there could have been another SUV or police officer on scene before Smith, then you must believe that there was a police conspiracy. So people push back against it because they find conspiracies distasteful, or they're pro-police or whatever. For whatever reason, they don't want to believe that, so they forget everything else. The problem with that is, I think the prosecutors' podcast, they actually talk about how fallible witness statements are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everyone agrees with that.
Yeah.
It's true. People's memories are squishy sometimes. Yeah. And I think it's a mistake to just dismiss outright, because what if the only thing that Karen got wrong was that it was a police SUV? One of the things that she said was she didn't recall the blue lights being on. Mm-hmm. And it seems unlikely to me that the police lights wouldn't have been on.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was just a regular civilian SUV that showed up 10 minutes before police got there, you could be dismissing the most key piece of evidence in the entire freaking case. That's the issue that I have with just like dismissing it outright.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other issue I have with it is that, at least to me, I found very suspicious something that people don't really bring up a whole lot. We've talked about it before, though. The fact that the police called witness A back twice to verify what she saw, as if something didn't add up to them. And, you know, we've talked about it being potentially the number on the SUV, but it also could have been the time. You know, it could have been where they're like, well, this doesn't match up with our arrival time for Cecil Smith, because that would be something they would note immediately. You know, they mm-hmm. they'd look at their logs and say, well, if they were taking a close look at the case, they would look at the right. logs and say, well, it looks like these times don't really match up. Cecil said he got there at 7:46, but from Karen's account, she would have been there before that, but somehow she saw him. Let's double check, because we don't want there to be outstanding questions. Not that they're trying to like cover things up or like,
yeah.
you know, make it fit, but they're just trying to figure out like, what are these discrepancies?
Right.
And people don't really mention that. And I find it very odd.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm crazy.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think so, because I think like they didn't ask her if she saw anyone on the road or like anything. They asked her about the car that she saw.
Right. Are you sure? Are you sure you saw that car?
Yeah. And I don't know how you just dismiss that outright. Well, I do know how you dismiss that outright, because you don't like conspiracy theories.
Yes.
But like, that's not the only explanation.
Right.
And I know that people jump all over me for the Bruce McKay thing, because he cleared the call at 7:28 p.m. And he,
mm-hmm.
to me, that suggests he might have been going to Maura's call. But the other thing is, that's public, is he would go home like halfway through his shift and take care of his dogs, let them out, feed them, whatever. If he was on the 4 to 11 shift, 4 p.m. to 11 p.m., literally the exact middle of his shift was 7:30 p.m. So it is not impossible for him to have been still going to the Littleton call, got called off. She sees him twice because he turns around, goes home to Lisbon, mm-hmm. takes out his dog. The next thing that she sees is this SUV at the scene. She assumes it's the cop that she just saw, and it's the civilian SUV.
Yeah, maybe a black SUV.
Yeah.
Now, personally, I find that somewhat unlikely. You would think it would be hard to mistake a civilian SUV for a police SUV in that scenario. But we've talked about witness memories before. You know, if she wasn't thinking about it at the time, then thinking back, it would be mm-hmm. maybe easy for her to replace a generic SUV with a police SUV on scene.
Right. And one of the things that Bill told me recently was when he was up searching for Maura with the Murrays, he rode in Fred's car like a number of times, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he could have sworn that Fred's Corolla was red. And it wasn't. It was gray. You can see it like on a couple mm-hmm. of different videos.
Yep.
His car was gray, but he could have sworn it was red, and he drove in it. So like,
yeah.
Witness memories, you fill in the blanks. If it doesn't register for a very specific reason, and even when it does, I think that there's research out there that says that the more profound an event is, like the more your memory is likely to start doing twists and turns.
Well, that would make sense, because you're going to keep thinking back on it. And every time you think back on it, you're going to have a chance to rewrite it.
Exactly. Right. So there's some reverse causality there, because you're only going to remember things that are significant, and you're only going to misremember things that are significant.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same time, yeah, it's very possible to me that altering that one thing, witness memory, could enlighten us to one of the clues in this case, and to just dismiss it is a little obtuse.
Yes. Yeah, people like to have questions answered, so I think that feeds into the... Well, Some people do. Some people like to not have questions answered. But I think in general, people like there to be answers to questions. So if it seems like there's a good answer, which is that, oh, it was one police officer, it seems simpler. It was just one person. It was the same person that she saw, the same car. And all I have to do is change one data point, which is his arrival time in the logs. Well,
a couple of data points, but yeah.
Yeah. And make it all fit with that information. Well, that's very neat and tidy.
Right.
And it doesn't require any other speculation or open-ended questions. But if you're trying to figure out what happened and you don't know what happened, to me, it would behoove you as an investigator to consider the possibility that the timestamps are all correct and witness A is correct. And in fact, what she saw was someone other than Cecil Smith. Because if she did see someone other than Cecil Smith, that's the biggest clue in the case. By far.
I know, right?
At the same time, I don't think we're saying that like everyone should be highly focused on this. Everyone should be focused on like, what car did she see? Who was it?
Right.
But it is, I think it's clearly an open question. And to say that it's not an open question, I think is just not looking objectively at the data.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about some of the other reasons to doubt Cecil's account. If, let's just follow the thread, if someone did get there before Cecil, let's go back to our prior thinking. I know you mentioned that, well, what if Witness A saw something that wasn't even a police officer? But what if it was a police officer? That's the kind of thing that Cecil, even if he didn't know it at the time, would probably have ultimately found out about. And since it's not in any dispatch logs, it's not documented anywhere, it's also the kind of thing that would be really suspicious and really maybe point to what happened to her. And if Cecil has knowledge that there was another officer there, and that clearly would seem to indicate that that officer maybe knows what happened, and Cecil has not said anything about it or done anything, at least maybe internally he does, but he knows the family doesn't know, and the family's trying to figure this out and is, you know, distraught over the loss of their loved one, that might be the sort of thing that would weigh on a person.
Right.
And maybe cause them to later in life do something tragic and drastic.
Yeah. And I don't want to pick on them too much, even though they picked on me a little bit. But this is one where I totally want to put it on the prosecutor's podcast because they brought it up first. So
really?
Yeah. So the prosecutors, they talked about Cecil's suicide.
Okay.
And I'm not inclined to talk about it.
Sure.
Because at its base, it's a health issue, really. I genuinely feel awful for his family.
Yeah.
I don't want to imply that he had anything to do with Maura's disappearance. At the same time, he was questioned by police about Maura's case several hours before he died.
Right.
So I don't think that it's right to jump to any kind of conclusion. But I also think it could potentially be negligent to avoid that data point.
Right. Yes, and I would say it's also malpractice to suggest that he was driven by internet trolls.
Right.
The fact that that explanation is brought up, to me, demonstrates it does beg an explanation, but not that one, because that's a terrible bullshit explanation that doesn't make any sense, because it's just not true, as far as we know, that he was like hounded by people. And even if he was, why would being interviewed by the police about the case drive him to, you know, to me, just the far more relevant data point, and I know a lot of people don't know it, is that he was interviewed beforehand, maybe.
Right.
Now, it could also just be that it was an emotional thing for him, so it was a trigger for other issues that he had.
A whole pile of things going on in his life. He was ill.
Right. Has the family, has Fred gone after him?
No.
I never got the impression they did. We know that Fred had words about Monaghan. Right?
Monaghan.
Yeah, but not necessarily about
Jeff Williams
Cecil.
And Officer Monaghan have been the most targeted police officers by far.
Yeah.
By far. I think that after the oxygen show, more people looked at Cecil, probably for the wrong reasons. I mean, the fact that he was nervous, like, Jesus, that's so unfair.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not fair. But the things that he said, on the other hand.
Right. It's really frustrating because people don't really focus on what he said. They focus on his demeanor. Oh, he looks so suspicious. Oh, he, which is one of the things that drives me crazy about this topic, this genre, this true crime thing, is that like so many people just focus on like the wrong stuff. Like, look at the data, look at the information. Like, does his explanation of what happened make sense? Right. And the shortcut, the route, to me is like the most insane thing I've ever seen that people just accept. I get that why he would say it, but why would anybody look at that and think that that makes sense? It's clearly trying to fit how he could have passed witness A twice. He came up with an explanation, but it's like, yeah, but that explanation doesn't, that only makes sense after the fact. Why would you have done it at the time? Like, right. That only makes sense when you try to figure out how to explain how you could have passed her twice. It doesn't make sense for Cecil Smith at the moment it's happening to take that route.
Yeah. I haven't been able to confirm that that road is open in the winter. There's no houses on
it. It's a shit-tastic road. It's a dangerous road to be taking at the speed he would have had to been taking it to overtake her.
It doesn't make sense at all. You know what would answer all of these questions?
Oh, what's that?
Well, so when I sent write-to-know requests, FOIA requests for the 911 calls years ago, an attorney for the state had mentioned to me that there's a 25-minute recording that has all of the dispatch chatter between what I would presume to be 7:27 when the call was initiated and the next 25 minutes. So from 7:27 to 7:52. They have all of the chatter on the police radio that they could make available to the public to answer every single one of these questions. When did Cecil Smith show up? Where was McKay going? What was the order of events that occurred? How long did Maura actually have to disappear? Was it 3 minutes or was it 20 minutes? Because that is a huge difference. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're not releasing it, I can't understand it. But I also can't understand how you can say that there's a reasonably anticipated expectation of a law enforcement proceeding and also say that it's a cold case. But that's what people should want. If they want to answer this question and they want to put to bed all of the police conspiracies.
Well, people don't know that exists. People don't know that that exists other than from what you've said. But
yeah, and I haven't said it on this podcast, I don't think. I know I said it on True Crime Garage.
Yeah.
But if you want an answer to this, if you want an answer to any question about the timeline, to any question about who's at the scene.
If you want to shut us up about Bruce McKay.
Yes. If you want me to shut the fuck up. Then you want the 25-minute recording.
Yeah. Maybe we're totally wrong.
Well, even if we're wrong, it's...
Shut us up. Shut us up.
Did have a real aha moment that didn't make it in the show when we did the drive, backtracked her time from Beaver Pond and said, holy crap.
She saw Cecil Smith.
Cecil Smith. She saw what she saw.
So this is witness A that we're talking about. Was it 7:37?
It was about, so it was about 10. Yeah. Art and I arrived about 10 minutes before Cecil called in.
Right. Okay.
But this stuff started exploding online and developing into this huge, you know, police conspiracy thing. And one of the first things we said to law enforcement at Distrelzin is we want to put this, figure out what, you know, what happened here and put this particular issue to bed. And we were able to do that.
And it's really funny because even when they explained their reasoning for why they were so adamant that it was Cecil, they're like, we did the drive. We did the drive from Beaver Pond. And we looked at each other and we're like, it was Cecil. She saw Cecil. And then that's immediately followed by, oh, but we did it in about 10 minutes quicker than she did. Like, what? What did you just say?
Yeah.
You're explaining a discrepancy
mm-hmm.
as you're saying that there isn't one.
Yep.
It's amazing.
And again, it's all just to make Cecil, the officer who Karen Witness A says that she saw. That's literally the only reason to put him at 7:35 arrival time. There's no other reason.
Yeah.